Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, if you heard the president's address this week, you'll know he's bringing back DACA. So we're going to tag on to that news by introducing you to one of the founders of immigrationhelp.org, which believes immigrants make America great. So we'll learn how this grassroots organization is making immigrating to the United States easy, safe, and free by combining the power of technology with attorneys to help everyone who's qualified achieve the American dream. Then we're going to meet the individual leading Connecticut's first statewide LGBTQ plus survey through the General Assembly's Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity, which aims to enhance an understanding of the number of people that identify as part of the LGBTQ plus community and identify the needs of our state's LGBTQ plus community members. Finally, we're going to call on all of our loyal For the People listeners to bring a friend and sign up for this year's virtual NAMI walks and to put your feet to the street in support of defeating the stigmas against those of us with mental health and related issues and to help provide the support our loved ones grappling with related challenges need to survive and thrive. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The most recent U.S. Geological Survey study undertaken in cooperation with Connecticut's Department of Public Health projects that approximately 4% of private wells across Connecticut contain water with arsenic at concentrations higher than the Environmental Protection Agency's maximum contaminant level for public drinking water supplies. The research also projects that almost 5% of private wells in the state have uranium concentrations higher than the EPA standards. As a result, Connecticut DPH officials urge all private well owners to have their water tested for possible arsenic and uranium. If you'd like more information on finding a testing lab, just go to ct.gov/DPH/private wells. So a few days ago, perhaps you were tuning in here in Connecticut around 9 p.m. to hear President Joe Biden. He really covered a huge punch list of news activities and plans in his address on the eve of his 100th day in office. And one of the things that resonated was his support for DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This U.S. immigration policy allows some individuals to come to the country and receive a deferred action from deportation and become eligible for a work permit. And that brings me to an outreach letter that I received from our guest on the line this morning, calling in from Harvard up in Cambridge. Fernando Urbina is on the line with us, and he is with an organization called Immigration Help. He helped co-find the organization. And Immigration Help believes immigrants make America great. So we're going to learn how this grassroots organization is making immigration to the United States easy, safe, and free by combining the power of technology with attorneys to help everyone who's qualified achieve that American dream. Fernando, welcome, and such an honor and pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Likewise.
So it sounds like you're out there on or near the street up in the greater Boston area. So we'll ask our listeners to forgive the background noise. But, you know, sometimes you got to get out there to the people to get the mission accomplished. Right.
So, exactly.
Yeah. So first, tell me a little bit about yourself. What brought you to Harvard?
Sure. So I am currently a junior at Harvard studying government with a secondary field, which is essentially a minor in ethnicity, migration, and rights. Mm. And I'm originally from a very small town in Michigan, about 3,000 people total in the town. But the reason why I got involved with immigrationhelp.org is because I am the son of a Mexican immigrant. And so I remember my mom went through a very complicated naturalization process, and so I wanted to be part of a team to help streamline these processes and made them more accessible.
Very good. Do you recall and draw inspiration from the challenges that your mom faced as you saw her growing up and you started to realize that somebody needed to make a difference and then eventually decided it was going to be you?
Oh, absolutely. So her process was very long and complicated. And I remember she would spend lots of hours working on the applications and then studying for the naturalization test. And all in all, it just took so much time. And so I wanted to be part of a team that helped make this easier for people. And so I got to Harvard, began studying different things related to migration and immigration, and fell in love with the work. And here I am today, Director of Outreach at immigrationhelp.org.
Well, tell me how the whole idea for this came together. Was it just like flipping on a light switch, or was it sort of a building process?
Yeah, absolutely. So immigrationhelp.org started in 2019, and it was co-founded by the husband of a immigrant from Romania. And so he is an attorney and started a similar nonprofit called, or not, no longer nonprofit, but he started a similar organization called Upsolve, and Upsolve helps individuals file for bankruptcy using an online platform. And so he used those skills that he had gained founding Upsolve and translated them to immigrationhelp.org to help individuals prepare their immigration forms for free.
Oh, okay. So he's using the technology he developed for a for-profit venture and adopted it for the nonprofit that you're now heading up.
Exactly. Correct.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the experiences that you had as you were meeting people here now, 15, 20 years later, after you were a witness to your mom's challenges. Have you found that leading up to the establishment of immigrationhelp.org, that anything had improved?
Some things have improved. So since then, of course, the DACA program was formed, which allows individuals to be protected from deportation, also allows them to gain work permits that they can work legally within the United States. But a lot also has gotten worse, especially under the previous administration. We saw that it got a lot harder for individuals to apply for different benefits and obtain different statuses. And so that has definitely made our work much more important. Under the current administration, we're hoping that immigration reform is a lot more positive and people get more access.
Now, in the course of developing this, tell us a little bit about how it all came together. Do you have a fairly large team of immigrationhelp.org staffers or colleagues, or is it mostly you and a couple of other people and then a large network of volunteers?
So we're a pretty small team. We are a team of 8 individuals at the moment, and this consists of undergraduate students, law students, attorneys, and paralegals. And so that is our small team at the moment. And then what we are also doing at the moment right now is partnering with other organizations that also help immigrants. And some of them also help immigrants file their forms, but maybe they don't have the capacity. And so what they're doing is referring individuals to us. And then we'll also be starting a training program so that these individuals from other organizations can help individuals prepare the immigration forms for free as well.
So here you are on the radio broadcasting throughout most of Connecticut, out onto Long Island, mm-hmm. down into the Westchester and Metro New York area. You're certainly talking to a region that is rich with both lawyers, legal scholars, and law schools, many of whom have hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who are activist-minded like yourself, Dolphin, who may be able to lend their expertise to this. Yale, as you know, Quinnipiac, a number of other great law schools within the sound of our voices. Would you be interested in drawing a number of these people to the cause to put some numbers to the initiative that you're trying to deliver for people who are applying?
Well, absolutely. We can always use the help of pro bono attorneys or volunteers. And so their help is always much appreciated and really valued within our organization because this allows us to help many, many more people complete their applications for free. And so if there's anyone that would like to help us out and volunteer, all they would need to do is reach us at help@immigrationhelp.org and let us know.
Very good. Before we talk about what people should expect once they call you for support, let's talk about some of the people that you've already helped and met in this journey of yours since forming immigrationhelp.org. Are there any particular individuals that were really sort of facing a life-challenging or perhaps even life-endangering situation as a result of their potential deportation who have found relief and respite and the ability to, get assigned some protections under the program thanks to your help?
Yeah, so we definitely have many individuals with very interesting stories. And so some of the individuals that we've helped obtain DACA status have been able to since then obtain college degrees, get work permits that they can provide for their families, and most importantly, stay within the country. And all of these are really important for them to be able to provide for their families and support them. And so this makes us motivated to continue doing our work, just seeing how appreciative people are and how life-changing it can be.
That's great. And this is also kind of a hybrid initiative because you're not only bringing to bear the power of technology as it was developed by your founder and lent over to the nonprofit initiative, but you're also tapping the expertise of now the half dozen plus law students and volunteers that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about how people can get support if they're coming to you for assistance.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really simple to get our help. All individuals need to do is visit our website at immigrationhelp.org. There they will complete our application, which takes about 5 to 10 minutes to complete on average. This application will then screen their cases for eligibility and prepare the required forms and supporting documents needed. And then our team will review these documents for free and then work with the individual throughout the process to correct any errors before they're submitted to USCIS. So this will significantly reduce the likelihood that they're rejected.
So, Fernando, as you've been doing this now for a while, what are the biggest sticking points or challenges that people have in trying to complete this process on their own and without the kind of support that immigrationhelp.org can provide?
Right. So many of these individuals are more than capable of completing these forms on their own. But if there are small errors within the application, this will significantly increase the likelihood that they're rejected. And so a lot of people will occasionally miss questions or fill in a question incorrectly or not put an A, for example, or not applicable on an answer where they should. And these are just really small things that we can help point out and make sure that are correct so that the applications don't get rejected. And these are things that most people don't realize to look for.
So as we get down toward the end of our conversation, Fernando, another important component of making sure that immigrationhelp.org can be sustainable and thrive and expand well beyond the greater Boston area is to provide some financial underwriting. And it's tough to ask people. There's a lot of competition from service agencies that are delivering immediate, emergent different services, but if folks who may be listening have experienced the frustration of trying to get into the DACA program and successfully navigate the process, or some other folks who are dear to the cause, perhaps they would like to offer some support. What could those who are supporting immigrationhelp.org do in terms of either direct financial assistance? And if they do, what is it exactly they're supporting? Or perhaps what could volunteers do if they're not legal experts?
Mm-hmm, definitely. So we certainly rely on the financial support of individuals across the whole country who are passionate about helping us help immigrants across the entire nation. And so for those individuals, what they can do is visit immigrationhelp.org. And there we have a link for people to donate to our organization. And what that helps is be able to pay for some of our staff that are helping increase awareness across the entire country about our services, but then also directly working with individuals to make sure that their applications are filled out correctly. And for those who are not able to support financially, we definitely always need support in other areas, such as connecting with individuals, helping increase awareness, going on to communities and sharing information about our organization. And so those individuals can also reach out to us at help@immigrationhelp.org if they're interested in getting involved.
So hearing your answer, maybe I misspoke in saying that right now your services are sort of generating support around the greater Boston area. Are you already providing help through the website and your relatively small team of staff outside of the greater Boston area and in other areas of the country?
Yeah, so we help individuals across the entire U.S. From coast to coast. And so as of now, we have helped several thousands of individuals prepare their immigration forms for free. But we have helped them at different stages of the process, from helping them determine whether they're eligible to fully completing their forms for them and submitting to USCIS.
Thank you. Our guest this morning is Fernando Urbina. He's a Harvard University student and the point man behind immigrationhelp.org, which believes immigrants make America great. And this organization is making immigrating to the United States easy, safe, and free, combining the power of technology with attorneys and others to help everyone who's qualified to achieve the American dream successful. Fernando, congratulations, and thank you so much for your efforts. And we hope that our sharing the word about your organization here in Connecticut and the Northeast region makes a difference and gets folks the help they need and gets you the help you need to continue and grow immigrationhelp.org. Thank you so much. All right. Now we're going to reel it back here to Connecticut and talk about another significant development that's happening here. Actually, something quite groundbreaking. I'm talking about Connecticut's first ever LGBTQ community survey. We're going to be talking about that with our guest, who's Stephen Hernandez. He's the executive director of Connecticut's Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity. And lots to talk about in regards to this office. But as we kind of broached as we talked to our prior guest, Stephen, probably a big morning at your office here on the heels of President Biden's speech to the legislature, the Congress last night, as we record this here on Thursday morning. What are a few of the most exciting things that you heard from our new president?
Thank you, John. First of all, thank you so much for having us today. And you're right, it is a big morning, because I think what resonated with us mostly and foremostly is that many of the national issues that President Biden highlighted in his speech last night are issues that we've been focusing on here in the state of Connecticut. And these are issues that really do impact our six jurisdictions as they are outlined by statute for our commission. So just so you know, our commission is a nonpartisan arm of the legislature. We are actually an agency that advises the legislature on policy impacting women, children, and seniors and people of color in the state. So we really have a far-reaching jurisdiction. We, of course, focus on equity and opportunity, those touch points where we could do our best to focus our efforts to help historically and disproportionately underserved, underrepresented, and under-resourced communities, but also opportunities. So also identifying where our communities can find access to not only success, but also opportunity in the state and the future of the state, having a stake in the future of the state. So that's a little bit about our commission. So in that context, you know, when you think about a jobs plan that is as ambitious as this president, so that when you think about infrastructure plan that really implicates Connecticut directly and Connecticut's people directly, you know, gun control, something that has been at the heart of Connecticut's work for many years, even before Sandy Hook, I must say, but really galvanized in the state around Sandy Hook. And police reform this last year has really, what you've really seen is the state coming together around not only how it is that we look at modern policing, but how we improve it from the ground up. And that is a community effort. And you know, the whole notion of community policing really begins and ends with community input and community stakeholding. And that's important because I'll tell you, if the community isn't part of the expectations of the police force, or for that matter, any other public servant, then they are acting to my mind, without legitimacy. So it's important that the community be a key and integral part of police reform.
Yeah. Well, it was quite a moment to see the president look straight into the camera and refer to the LGBTQ community, especially youngsters and those in the trans community particularly, and just utter those words, "I've got your back." That was something that I could not ever imagine coming out of the mouths of anyone near and dear to the last administration.
John, I'll tell you what, that moment, I think you captured it plainly and simply. The LGBTQ plus community in the state of Connecticut, as you know, really spans all of our jurisdictions cross-generationally. Our people are in all walks of life. We occupy every position in government, every position in workforce, every position in family infrastructure and otherwise that anybody else does in the state. And what's beautiful about that message is that so often our people really have to live in silence, even today, John. You know, let's talk about just a senior jurisdiction, for instance. I know that you probably know that many of our seniors in the state of Connecticut, an aging state is what we call it, often have to go back into the closet as they think about their long-term care and long-term life needs. And that's shameful. So for the president, and then, of course, there's been the whole controversy of trans children competing yes. based on their identity in sports in the state. Yep. And so what we found in that message last night, that message of hope, that message of safety, that message of recognition, that is life-saving work. Those are life-saving words. And it, I know it sounds hyperbolic because, you know, from the outside, if you think about it, how is it that those few words could really offer so much? Well, they do, because it is invisibility and silence that is death for so many in our community. It has been that way forever. Mm. And to have the leader of the free world really utter those words was powerful, to say the least. I think you captured it perfectly, John.
Yeah. And we don't really get political here on the award-winning For the People, despite our title. But to illustrate the alternate reality over what we saw over the past 4 years versus the past few months, I think is really important as we kind of get into the subject that we're going to be touching on in the next few minutes. But before we get into talking about the LGBTQ plus community survey, speak to the other constituents that your office interacts with and supports, and some of the other important work that you're doing on behalf of those groups in the state.
Well, thank you for that. So, as I said, we are a collaboration, a conglomerate of six former commissions. And the six were the Women's Commission, the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women, the Children's Commission, the Seniors Commission, African American Affairs, Asian Pacific Islander Affairs, and Latin and Puerto Rican Affairs in the state of Connecticut. And what this has done for us to be able to bring these communities together in many ways to do work intersectionally, because as we know, there I can't think of one issue that doesn't impact one community without impacting other communities cross-sectionally, cross-generationally, cross-silo. So understanding those things that bind us, those things that link us, is really critically important. When you think of children, for instance, and you think of access to a good education, a free education that is really at the hallmark of long-term success, when you think of our seniors and aging in place is something that we've really committed to in the state of Connecticut. What does that mean? How is it that we have livable communities in the state of Connecticut? That's really our focus in our seniors' work. In our work with women's in the Women's Subcommission, we work very closely with other women's organizations across the state on access. Pay equity is huge. Access to childcare, which is not just a women's issue, but a family issue as well. But so many of our women are also providers of childcare. So it's critically important that we understand that. And on our ethnicity subcommission, African American Affairs, Asian Pacific Islander, Latino and Puerto Rican, you know, what we have found in this last year is that there is more that binds us than not. And the social justice movement, the social justice re-energizing that we've seen in the last year has really created opportunities for our communities of color to work together to end discrimination, to end targeting. So I've been really heartened by how it is that our constituencies have really proved the point of coming together on behalf of people who are under-resourced and underrepresented. Mm. And I can tell you that in every one of these sectors, LGBTQ plus people are living and leading. And that's critically important to know. And, you know, you mentioned our survey, and that is really the underlying reason for our survey, is to figure out where our people are, what their needs are, what their hopes and aspirations are, and how it is that we can work together to help them achieve that.
Great. Well, we've set up nicely our rest of our conversation after the break, but also hearing that great news from you, Stephen Hernandez, and really being challenged to kind of get my mind around that punch list of former commissions that all had to come together under the umbrella that you are now overseeing. And, you know, when you look across the state and you look at organizations like the DEEP or the DOT or the DMV, it really sounds like you've got your work cut out for you there. And I'm going to be really thrilled to be able to help you in promoting this LGBTQ plus survey. We'll be back with Stephen Hernandez, Executive Director of Connecticut's Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity and Opportunity. Stay with us if you are or know or love a member of the LGBTQ plus community. You're definitely going to want to hear the second segment of our interview with Stephen. So stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Do you know someone grappling with dementia or memory loss? Caregivers, family members, and friends of loved ones with dementia and Alzheimer's disease are invited to participate in a free 3-part virtual training program being offered by Wesley Village Senior Living Campus and the Alzheimer's Association. This 3-week webinar is scheduled for Tuesday evenings from 6 to 7:30 beginning May 4th and running through May 18th. Subjects include understanding Alzheimer's and dementia, understanding and responding to dementia-related behaviors, and how to introduce and discuss issues like driving, doctor visits, and legal or financial planning. Registration is required, however, and you'll get a Zoom link and meeting information. All you need to do is call 203 225-5024 or email lbisson@umh.org to sign up or visit the Wesley Village Senior Living website. We are back, and we've got about 6 or 7 minutes to cover a lot of ground remaining with Stephen Hernandez. He's executive director of the Connecticut Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity. And as you heard from our earlier few minutes of chatting, this organization does a huge amount of work for a huge number of constituencies here in Connecticut. We're going to spend the next few minutes just zeroing in on Connecticut's LGBTQ plus community with this groundbreaking, first-of-its-kind community survey. So, Stephen, beyond what you said as we went into the break, tell us a little bit about how this all came together.
Well, John, I have to say that this effort to really try and figure out where it is that our people are and what it is that they need was really an effort that started here at the legislature under the leadership of a couple of our openly gay and out legislators in the state of Connecticut. One, of course, is Representative Jeff Curry, and the other is Representative Raheb Ali Brennan. The two of them together worked tirelessly to not only bring attention to the invisibility of our communities all over the state. And what's incredible about our communities is that we really do span the life cycle. We span demographic. We are in every single community of the state. We are your siblings. We are your parents, your children, grandparents. We're everywhere. But the problem has always been with our community is silence and invisibility. And whenever a member of our community has to experience silence and invisibility across the life cycle, it can really perpetuate pain, it can perpetuate lack of access, all of the things that we know are critical for long-term success. You know, I really admire the work of True Colors, as you know, that for decades now has, sure, has provided an annual conference for LGBTQ plus kids in the state of Connecticut. And what was so powerful, and I know will be powerful again because they're going through a transition, but what's been so powerful about True Colors was that it gave voice and visibility to young people. We were able to come together and really celebrate each other, young people who are LGBTQ plus or their allies. In a way, this survey is a way for us to come together again in that way. It surveys adults in the various communities across Connecticut. Where are you? What are your needs? What would you like to see as part of your relationship to your local, state, and federal resources and government? What opportunities are you looking for? And I'll tell you, John, what's critical about this survey is that it is a point in time survey, but it is not the end of a conversation. It's the beginning of a conversation. It is intended that this network that was created by Legislative Fiat will continue its work even beyond the survey, using the information that we found in the survey and actually putting it to good use. How is it that we focus our resources for our communities? How do we help people serving agencies around communities actually find resources that they need? And how do we connect the dots across the state? You know, we have 169 towns. Sometimes it feels like 169 different spots on a map, but they do find ways of working together across jurisdiction, and that's how it is that we want to link our people to each other, but also to the rest of the larger community. It's so critical, John.
Well, I'm glad to hear you shout out Raheb, because on Pride Week last year, he provided such a touching, important interview on this program, speaking directly to any LGBTQ plus youths who might be listening, speaking as a peer who was very close to that age, as we know, and having come through many of the challenges that are experienced by so many thousands of other young people here in Connecticut. So kudos to you for allying with him. So in the last couple minutes that we have, Stephen, what do people need to know? Where do they need to go? And why is it so important for virtually every LGBTQ plus community member in Connecticut to link on and participate?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, we just went through a process, a every 10-year process of counting, of being counted, the census, which is going to have such critical impact in the state of Connecticut and beyond for the next 10 years. Being counted is critical. In some ways, this survey is a way for the LGBTQ plus community in Connecticut to be counted and for us to truly understand how it is that we focus resources around community. You know, this has never been done before, John, you know, and that's huge because just the effort alone to count, the effort alone to understand where our people are and what their needs are shows the commitment of this state and the commitment of communities to really come together and bring our forgotten parts of our communities closer together. But I'll tell you another thing that it does and another reason that this survey is so important is so that we see each other. And so that we see ourselves as part of that larger community. That's so critically important. And you know, and I appreciate you shouting out to Representative Raheb Ali Brennan because, you know, that message that he gave is the message of reaching out to that next generation who every day is born into this earth and by grace is a member of maybe a member of the LGBTQ plus community and wants to see themselves just the way anybody else would see themselves as part of the future of the state. It's, as I said before, it's life-saving work, but it's also empowerment, and it's how it is that we will be a better state and lead the nation in these efforts. So, we have a link to the survey on our website, the CWCSEO website. You can go to wp.cga.ct.gov. And then /CWCSEO, or just go to the Connecticut General Assembly's website, find the commission's site, and you'll find the survey. And I'll tell you, where the survey's going to be open deep into the summer, we want to make sure we reach as much of our communities as possible. We want to make sure that we hit all of the regions of Connecticut, from the quiet corner all the way down to the further southwest to the heart of Connecticut. There's so much diversity here, John. We want to make sure to find our people wherever they may be.
Excellent. Touting Connecticut's first LGBTQ plus community survey, Stephen Hernandez, Executive Director of Connecticut's Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity. Thank you so much. Look forward to coming back and talking with you once the survey is completed to find out what you're planning to do with all that information. And I'm really looking forward to our next conversation, Stephen. Thank you so much. Well, here we are in May, and that means it's time to get ready for one of the coolest and most important philanthropic efforts you might take up all month long. I'm talking about getting involved in the NAMI walks across Connecticut here. We promote them virtually every year here on the award-winning For the People, and our relationship with NAMI Connecticut goes back to when there were several NAMI chapters here in the state, a good 20, 25 years, perhaps. Joe Gatto is with us on the line. He's president of the board of NAMI Connecticut, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, if you are wondering what NAMI is all about. And if you'll hang around for about 10 or 15 minutes, you'll really find out what it's all about, because Joe is one of their dedicated representatives. So, Joe, great to meet you.
Well, John, thank you. It's a pleasure to be joining you today, and thanks for inviting me.
Sure. So let's start talking a little bit about you and your passion for NAMI. When did that all start, and how did you learn about this organization?
Well, I joined the board of directors in 2017, and I got involved with the organization when within our extended family, we had a crisis. One of our nephews was going through a very, very tough time in college, and we needed help. And, from there, I came to grow a lot of respect for the organization, for the volunteers, and the really important things that NAMI does for family members and loved ones with folks with lived experience, and also for people getting through their own mental health challenges. And, this is an area where historically people have often looked the other way, or there's been stigma. And the reality is in America, large number of families have from time to time mental health challenges, and it's good to know that there's an organization out there that provides help and hope.
Great. It was probably about 10 or 11 months ago that we had another representative from NAMI Connecticut on the program. And we were just starting to hear then about how the pandemic was impacting the community of constituents who come to NAMI, and how NAMI was responding and NAMI Connecticut was responding to that. Now that we have, almost a year to kind of look in the rearview mirror, can you pick it up from there and tell us how NAMI Connecticut weathered the storm and managed to so successfully navigate its way through the peaks and valleys of the balance of this COVID era that we're still in the midst of? From your perspective, it sounds like you guys did just a fantastic job. You were way up in front in getting in on the virtual and telehealth style activities. As chairman of the board, you got to be pretty proud of the way things were handled.
Well, yeah, thanks, John. I appreciate that. Let me start by saying that, mental health issues have been with us as a society for a very, very long time, but clearly now these mental health issues with the pandemic, I mean, they're affecting all families. The recent CDC data shows that about 40% of Americans are suffering from some mental illness. I mean, that's double the 1 in 5 level reported before COVID-19 hit. And, it's hitting young people the hardest. It's anxiety, it's depression, trauma, and worsening of more serious conditions. We're hearing it every day in calls to our warm line, people seeking help. This year's really been damaging to our collective mental health.
The isolation.
Hitting people. Oh, yes.
The isolation.
The isolation.
Living inside your own
head.
Yeah.
Yeah. The isolation, the loneliness, the loss of loved ones, job loss, lives on hold. And, you asked about Connecticut. Connecticut is the second leading state to report through the crisis text line some of the conditions that are affecting our people. And the stats are, over the last year, 36% of folks have been calling in with relationships under real pressure, 35% deep depression and sadness, isolation and loneliness, 18%, and suicidality, right around 18%, which is very scary. The needs for help, education, and support, I have to say, are greater than I've ever seen. And I know you were asking about what's NAMI Connecticut doing, and maybe a little bit about what others out there might do with us. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's worth saying and always repeating that NAMI Connecticut and the NAMI affiliates across the state, including NAMI Fairfield and NAMI Southwest and Fairfield County, offer free educational programs, support groups, and services for family members, people living with mental health conditions, for professionals, and the community at large. And, I could talk a little bit about what some of these are and what they mean to folks, but I'd say that first and foremost, our family-to-family program, which is for family members who've got someone in their family going through a tough time. And many people come to NAMI for the family-to-family classes because they help people get through a family crisis. And this is probably one of our most important educational services. I have seen personally folks go through these programs. My wife actually teaches one of them. We've participated in a number of these programs. They make an enormous difference in people's lives when they've got a kid, another family member going through a crisis, and they need help and they need it fast. Our support groups are critical on an ongoing basis. for people to keep up as they're going through challenging changes, and they need to talk with other people who know, have been there, and care. And then finally, I'd say that this organization has done a phenomenal job delivering all of our services, lots of events with well-renowned professionals and authorities in the mental health area, all online. And I must say, for all of our services, John, free of charge to anybody interested in learning and helping their own mental health, that of family members, and again, the community at large.
We're talking with Joe Gatto. He's president of the board of NAMI Connecticut, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, doing incredible work for the entire length of our relationship here with that organization, going back a couple decades plus, and now under maybe the greatest crush of need for support that NAMI Connecticut has ever seen. I mean, Joe, we've weathered some pretty intense disasters, financial crises, political crises. They're all dwarfed compared to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I have to imagine that all of the people who are part of the NAMI support network delivering the services and assistance and the warm line response and the family to family, the burnout factor or at least the gas in the tank getting down to empty has to be something that's on your mind. And that leads me to ask you about how folks that might be listening to the program can come to your organization to learn how to be, like the cavalry coming to help. I mean, can NAMI use injection of new blood when it comes to the volunteers and professionals that support the folks and the many more folks these days who are coming to you for help?
Well, John, thank you. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to answer that question on getting involved with NAMI. I'd say volunteer, become a member of the organization. It is a great organization, diverse, inclusive. When I say becoming a member, we will subsidize membership dues for people who need it. And there's a lot to do. Specifically, from a volunteering standpoint, folks can volunteer to lead support groups, help put together events, and actually teach classes. But since our courses and classes are all evidence-based, it's important that volunteers get the training before leading these classes, and we provide that training, again, all free of charge and dependent on our donors and also from our very close relationship with state organizations, including DEMIS. I think spreading the word and building awareness and combating stigma in this area is incredibly important. And I think everyone who becomes involved with the organization fortunately plays that role. And then lastly, I'd say, and we can talk about this a little bit more, getting involved in the NAMI walk. It's a one day. It's a lot of fun. And it's a chance for us all to come together in support of mental health.
Well, let's get people excited and signed up. How is the NAMI walk planned to be presented this year?
Well, you know, historically, these walks have been live. And we did 2 years ago a major walk in Hartford, but we wanted to draw people from across the state. And so we had a walk in Westport at the state park, which was fantastic. We attract hundreds of people to the walk when we're not in the middle of a pandemic. This year will be our second year with a virtual walk, and that is going to be on May 22nd, Saturday. And we're calling it Join Us for a United Day of Hope and Help. And what we're going to be doing is creating virtually a virtual experience. Uniting with NAMI walks across the entire United States. And what it means is that we're looking to participants to use their own creativity. Some people are planning on walking 5 kilometers their way, 7,000 steps. Others are looking at doing 5 kilometers on a treadmill or stationary bike, but there's no mandatory minimum amount of treading or biking or walking here. It's up to you. Creating a safe and socially distanced stroll with family members or vaccinated friends in their neighborhood, or you know, planning a craft day with kids or baking with family members. We're really leaving it up to people to get involved, have a fun day, be creative, and importantly, support this incredibly important fundraising event for NAMI Connecticut and build awareness for mental health. And I'd say if you're interested, and I'd encourage you to do so, check out our website, namict.org. That's namict.org, to learn more information, to get involved, to donate, and also to take a closer look at some of our programs, support groups, and events. I think you're going to like what you find. And again, I'm delighted to be here sharing all this with you today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've got another a minute or two before we have to let you go, Joe. And I want to circle back because a little earlier you uttered the S word. And it's an S word that we actually use a lot here on the award winning For the People. And we can actually say it on radio. And that's stigma. I think still today, unfortunately, this growing number of people who may actually benefit most from the resources of NAMI Connecticut, who are maybe coming to the table or even thinking that something may be wrong and they need the help, they're not making that call because they are still saddled with a stigma about how other people might think of them if they admit to or assign themselves to some sort of mental health support. So in the last minute that we have with you, I'd like you to utilize the radio to speak directly to anyone who is not making the call to get help if they think they need it.
Well, I'd say this, John, there are a few S words, but let's focus on the stigma one first, because it has been an impediment. Employees have been concerned about notifying employers. Kids at school have been concerned in terms of their relationships with friends. I have to say, if there is a silver lining to this pandemic, and there are not many, I think we as a society are, I hope, for real this time, becoming a lot more serious and a lot more committed to understanding the benefits of diversity and inclusion, and understanding that we all bring something to this life and to this world, and that we recognize to a much greater degree, reading any of the newspapers, watching the television, seeing what's happening now with this new administration in Washington, that the understanding that many of these mental health challenges are going to be a lot simpler to address, and we're going to create a much more open society and an environment where people can live their lives without stigma as a result of the awareness building and the communication and the realization that everybody has something important to contribute, and that with that awareness, I think stigma will start to decline. It's going to take time for sure, but I'm seeing it every day, and I'm certainly heartened by seeing it some of the major employers taking a position on this issue. Stigma, both respect to mental health issues and substance abuse, which hits so many of the families across our country, and because people are afraid to seek help, many, many job hours are being lost, and people are suffering in silence without hope. This is absolutely a critical issue to get addressed. And for the first time in a long time, John, I'm seeing some really positive signs, and we're going to be at the front of this.
Well, that
organization.
That observation gives me a great joy and a great place to leave the conversation for now. Joe Gatto is president of the board of directors for NAMI Connecticut, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Their NAMI Walk virtual is available, and we hope to draw folks from all over Connecticut to participate this year. We're also hoping to promote volunteerism for those who might want to reach out and help folks who are feeling the depression and the anxiety and all of the issues that contribute to their mental health situation. We hope folks will come to the table to get that support as well. It all starts at namict.org, namict.org, and the good folks like Joe from NAMI Connecticut. Joe, thank you for your time this morning, and best of luck with the NAMI Walks virtual for 2021.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.